What is up, everybody? Thanks for listening to the On Fire podcast brought to you by NBC7 with Derek Togerson. I am Darnay Tribb. Derek, how are you?
Yeah, we're just trying to figure out what's coming down the pipeline next. It's been a surprisingly eventful week for, when the hot stove hasn't really started yet for the Padres.
I always wonder when we're in the off-season mode, are we going to have anything to talk about this week? And this week we certainly do, and we've got a great guest to sort through it all with. First things first, shout out to the sponsor of the On Fire podcast, OG, celebrating their 30th anniversary this year. All locations have enhanced patio dining for guests, adding space, tables, etc. Some have even added outdoor TVs. OG's also has new menu items. We know them for their pizza, but that's not all they do. How about the pesto shrimp pasta, angel hair pasta, creamy pesto sauce, sauteed red bell peppers, red onion, garlic, blackened shrimp, and Parmesan. Sounds pretty good. Think of OG's, whether you want to come in for a bite or take out and delivery. OG's also selling beer to go. And I think Padres fans cracked a few beers over the course of the week. Certainly on Monday, after getting some disappointing news, and maybe even on Wednesday, to celebrate the end of an era of sorts. And to discuss all of that, we welcome back Kyle Glazer, San Diego guy. Of course, you know him for his work on Baseball America. Kyle, how are you?
Doing all right. Thanks for having me on again. Always fun to jump back on with you guys.
And great to have you. And there's a lot to get through. Let's start with Wednesday's news. Ron Fowler's decision to step down. What was your reaction when you saw that headline come across?
Certainly a little bit of surprise, just because the Padres finally broke through this year. It seems like they're now on the upswing, just in terms of they have an exciting product on the field. The years of promises of a rebuild finally came to fruition. But obviously there's a very uncertain financial landscape in Major League Baseball, both what happened this year and what next year is going to look like. We have no idea how many fans are going to be allowed in the stands, even how many games are going to be played potentially, depending on where the virus is. There's a lot of uncertainty. So it was definitely a bit of a surprise, given that this is everything the Padres had worked for, and it would seem strange to step down right as they're finally the playoff contender they've been trying to get them to be. But you also understand there's just so much financial uncertainty that, you know, people have to make whatever decision works for them. And clearly, Ron Fowler felt like this was the best decision for him at this time.
Yeah, Ron said before the season the heads were going to roll if things didn't go well. I mean, I didn't think he'd go off himself if things were going well, you know, regardless. It's interesting. He's going to stay on as the old, you know, catch-all, quote, advisory type of role, and, of course, still work. He's been a big liaison for Major League Baseball and a big asset for Rob Manfred. I think because he's really good in the negotiating room. He gets along with the players union well, and he's able to – he was really one of the driving forces between some of the kind of agreements or concessions that have been made to even get baseball on the field the last few years. Do you think he might be focusing more now, trying to get away from the kind of everyday, day-to-day work of the Padres because they are in a good spot now, and maybe now kind of going on to more of that to work with MLB type of thing that he's been doing anyway, maybe take on a larger role in that regard?
That's certainly a part of the equation. Again, it's never one thing, but there's no question that the fact that he will be still involved in some form or fashion shows that, yes, this is someone that both the Padres and Major League Baseball value the opinion of and feel like is someone that is important to retain moving forward. You know, this isn't a case where, you know, Seidler bought out his stake in ownership and then he's just kind of going off into the wind. You know, clearly there's a level of involvement still that's going to be there, and he will still have an impact on this franchise and the game moving forward.
Functionally speaking, in terms of the day-to-day operations now of the Padres, Seidler's the one calling the shots instead of Fowler. What actually changes? What does this necessarily mean?
Yeah, so it's always difficult to predict the future, especially when you're talking about ownership levels, because different people, when they, you know, are in the background, then they step into the spotlight, sometimes will surprise you. But for the most part, there's been a sense that while Ron was obviously the guy who was the most outspoken and was really the front-facing person in the organization, I mean, Peter has been, you know, the primary investor. He's been the money guy, and he's had a big role in a lot of the decisions that have been made. You know, AJ Preller was Peter Seidler's guy. His commitment to sticking with Preller was, you know, a big part of this. So Peter Seidler has always had a significant share of the decision-making in the organization. He just was more of a background role. And we'll see if he steps into the foreground. Again, different owners, different personalities. Some are more outspoken and public-facing, others less so. In the past, he's obviously kind of let Ron do all the front-facing stuff. Whether he becomes the guy and does that now, we'll see. But he's always had a good chunk of the decision-making responsibilities, and if anything, it's only going to grow from here.
And our dealings with both Ron and Peter have always been very good. Peter, especially, he's just a good guy, you know. And he's had, as we know, he's had health problems. He has struggled with fought and beat cancer. I looked at this really as a real positive for him, because if he wasn't feeling good from a health perspective, he wouldn't be taking on this much more of an elevated role without someone like Ron to bounce things off of. So how much now do you think that he's been around baseball for a long time, been around professional sports for a long time, this is soccer, baseball, several different things. How do you think we'll really start to see now his personality start to kind of come to the forefront, and we'll get to know maybe even a little bit more about him? Because as you said, Ron's always kind of been, you know, the bullhorn for the ownership part of the organization. Will we now get to know Peter Seidler a little bit better?
Possibly. Again, it really is just a personality thing. And you look around Major League Baseball, and there are some chairmen, some majority owners who enjoy that. They enjoy being out front, you know, front and center, talking to reporters, being on television, really discussing things openly, and others really just kind of fall to the background. And because Peter Seidler has mostly been in the background, it's kind of TBD whether he'll step to the foreground here. We will probably see, you know, his personality and if he makes that decision, but it's TBD at this point.
So he's going to become baseball's Jerry Jones. That's what I heard.
I think there's only one Jerry Jones, and he's kind of on a tier all himself among sports owners with how public he is and how much weight he throws around.
There was speculation because of the events of this week and Theo Epstein's decision and just the timing of everything. People wanted to kind of go down that road. You're shaking your head and rolling your eyes.
He cut his teeth in San Diego.
It seemed like, Seidler in some of his comments was quick to make it clear, like, hey, we're good. The group that we have in place, like we're all set. Is that kind of the way you see it?
That's not how I see it. That is how it is. That was just people on Twitter having way too much time to throw random things against a wall and see what stuck. Theo Epstein is taking a year off. Peter Seidler bought out Ron Fowler shares, like, this isn't happening. Whatever happens years down the road, look, anything is possible. I'm not saying it will never, ever happen, but the idea that that was going to happen right now this year was never based in fact or reality or talking to anyone who's actually involved in the process. It was just people on Twitter throwing things out. And I was actually glad to see Peter Seidler come out and just put an end to that, be like, no, this is what we did, because yeah, that was a social media vortex, you know, going crazy.
We got to figure at this point, Theo has brought a World Series to Boston and to the north side of Chicago. Pretty much all he has left is he's got to go either to Cleveland, and they seem to be in pretty good hands, Seattle or San Diego. Like those are Texas. Those are the only other places he can go to end a long World Series drought, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, Cleveland is sort of the standard bearer there, although our editor at Baseball America, J.J. Cooper, threw out, he's thinking too small if he's sticking to Major League Baseball. He needs to go out to the English Premier League. There's some clubs out there who have 100-plus-year championship droughts. So we'll see. Again, I think a lot of people assume that general managers or executives have this big grand plan and they know exactly what they're going to do for their future, when in reality, they're just like you and me. They take it year by year, see where they're at. Sometimes they need a breather and they make a decision based on where they are in their lives. You know, it's anything is possible, but this idea that there's this grand plan where he's definitely going to take over this team 2 or 3 years from now is incorrect. We'll see what happens. There's been talk about him obviously getting involved in an ownership group. And again, it might not, if those ownership groups don't have an opening, they don't have any shares for him to purchase, or they don't want to sell to him, then he's going to have to go find somewhere else. I think we're thinking too small here to say, oh, it's going to be one of these three franchises. Like, there's so many things that are going to have to happen and so many factors at play. let's just see how it plays out and don't go crazy trying to predict the future here.
You know, you guys have obviously been around the club a lot longer than I have, just in my couple seasons, you know, with as far as Ron Fowler goes, you know, last year he has the now famous comment, heads are going to roll, makes it pretty clear what the expectations are. AJ Preller makes a bunch of moves. They get back in the playoffs, have one of their best seasons, albeit in 60 games in club history. Brown uniforms come back. He has a great last calendar year and then says farewell. When you consider his legacy, what do you think people remember about what Ron Fowler did with the Padres? How much of it is just what has happened in the year leading up to his exit?
Yeah, I mean, he deserves a lot of credit. You know, him and Peter Seidler and the rest of the ownership group, you know, they stopped with this fiction of San Diego being a small market. It's not. You look at population, you look at the amount of money surrounding, whether you're Coronado, La Jolla, Rancho Santa Fe, there was no reason for this team not to be able to get into that, you know, mid-tier payroll range, 15th, you know, to 20th range. And they did. They brought in, you know, big name free agents. They spent appropriately for what this market size actually is, not what, you know, former ownership said it was in order to not have to ever spend any money. I think people appreciate he was very forthright and upfront with fans. There were times he received criticism for saying too much. In my opinion, I have a lot of respect for people who tell it how it is and are real with people. And I think Ron Fowler did that a lot. And I give him credit for that, even when the words weren't the kindest or the prettiest. I think it's important to be real and honest. I think people do and should look back at, you know, Ron Fowler's time as kind of the face of the Padres ownership group as a positive one. This was not a good organization when they took it over. They were not really invested in the right places to have any kind of sustainable long-term success on the field. They were too busy with gimmicks to try and attract fans than actually putting a good product on the field. And I think that they did a really good job focusing on the right places. They beefed up and spent in scouting and player development. They beefed up and spent to bring in some really good front office people. They eventually invested in the product on the field. So all in all, I think you have to look at the Ron Fowler era, if you will, positively. And again, it's not over. He's still going to have a say in decisions moving forward. He's going to be part of upcoming labor negotiations. So the book isn't closed, but from 2012 to now, yeah, absolutely. You look on this favorably.
Yeah, I think people forget just how bad the organization was when he really jumped in to, I don't think it's overstating saying rescue it. They had just gone through the messy Moores to Morad situation. And that was a complete disaster. Major League Baseball should have never approved the sale to Jeff Morad and his group. He took it even further into the dumps than it was, had all kinds of financial problems. You had the issues with the TV contract and whether or not that was going to work out. And then basically Morad got more or less kicked out of town by Major League Baseball after they realized the error that they had made. And then here comes Ron, a good San Diego guy, puts together a group, and he not only fixes the financial situation, he then brings the All-Star game to Petco Park, which was long, long, long overdue for a ballpark like this. Puts Petco Park on the map as one of the top three perennially ballparks in Major League Baseball. And then, as you said, there's everything with player development and payroll and spending and revamping the entire minor league system and adding to scouting and everything, all the money they put in the infrastructure. Where this team would be right now without that ownership group, it would be nowhere near where it is as we're sitting here talking about the potential of the San Diego Padres in 2021 and moving on.
There's no question. I think people, because of short memories, forget just what a disaster everything was, as you mentioned, with the Moores to Morad transition back to Moores. That was a cluster. It never should have happened. Major League Baseball completely failed to do their due diligence. There's a lot going on there with, you know, Moore's divorce and then, you know, going to Morad, who did not have the money for this. And then just everything that happened in terms of that entire process over those couple of years. It was a mess. It was, the Padres were frankly, I don't want to say irrelevant team, but they were not considered a team that anyone really took seriously. They, you know, they'd had success in 05 and 06, but they blew big leads in 07 and 2010. Ownership was a disaster. Drafting had been absolutely horrendous. Their, you know, international program was nowhere near some of the other top organizations in baseball. And again, give them credit for what they did. They came in, they really, really did a good job of not just, you know, throwing a bunch of dollars at free agents in the major leagues. They understood that in order to make this sustainable, they had to improve the farm system. They had to invest internationally. And on top of that, throw money at the major league product as well. And I think they did a really good job of understanding you have to do it at every level. If you only invest in drafting, but you don't invest in player development or the major league product, you're not going to win. If you only invest in player development, but you don't have good scouts and you aren't willing to pay guys in the majors, you're also not going to win. And if all you do is throw money at free agents, but you don't draft or develop well, you're also not going to win. I think they did a really good job over time doing all three and understanding that that's how you build a sustainable winner. And again, just give them all the credit in the world for bringing in the right people to do that and putting up the money to do it effectively.
We can look at their draft history during that time, and it's from Matt Bush to Donovan Tate to Matt Antonelli to, is it Alan Dykstra? Some Dykstra dude. I remember one year they had five of the top 60 picks, and the only guy who turned out to be anything was Corey Kluber. And then of course he has the two botched Tommy John surgeries by no fault of his own. He was actually looking like he was going to be a very good starting pitcher. And I know Darren Balsley loved him. They couldn't figure out a way to get anything done. And you mentioned the international thing. The Padres are one of the first big league clubs to put together a dedicated Dominican academy, and then nothing ever came out of it, which was really, really strange to me. And that's, I think that goes back to, as you were saying, player development. You work a lot on you know, the prospects and things. Can you kind of walk, for folks who don't know, when we say player development, it's not just drafting a stud and then sticking, it's not like, okay, Spencer Torkelson, we know, was going to be a stud. He hits everything. You don't just draft him, give him 50 games in the minor leagues and stick him in the major leagues. What is player development for a major league baseball club?
It's hiring the right coaches. It's hiring the right coordinators and instructors. It's having the right facilities and putting your minor leaguers in stadiums that, you know, are up to par in terms of, you know, weight rooms, in terms of good turf, in terms of, you know, good locker room setups. It's all the little things, making sure that these guys are in the best environments possible to grow. I think that they're, or a lot of times fans make the assumption, oh, this guy, you know, turned out to be great. It was a great drafting job. Oh, this guy busted. It was a terrible scouting job. Well, as I've done this job more and more, I've learned that a lot of the guys you think of as draft busts, a lot of times is because their player development was terrible. They took a guy who just, let's just say, you know, had a really good, you know, sinker slider mix, and they tried to make him a fastball curveball guy. They took away what made him good in the first place. Or the other side, there's one organization I can think of in particular that takes pitchers and says, you're going to pitch this way. And more often than not, they never make it because that's not their strength. Or, you know, they take guys who they take them because they like their swing, and then they just try and change their swing entirely. Organizations who try and overhaul players as opposed to making them the best versions of themselves, those are two very different things. So it's really, really critical for teams to understand that we need to hire coaches who are very, very good. And it's not about them and their egos and saying, oh, I'm going to fix you. It's about, let me help you be the best version of yourself. I think anyone who's ever played at any level knows the value of having a good coach versus a bad coach. And that doesn't change in the minors. I think people need to understand there are good coaches and bad coaches in professional baseball, just as there are college baseball, high school baseball, take your pick. So it's hiring the right people. And again, just having the right facilities. And sometimes it's as little as promoting guys who deserve to be promoted. You know, there's some organizations that will promote guys. Oh, he was a first rounder, so we have to bring him up even though he's terrible. When the five guys who are outperforming him get left in the minors, that creates a really toxic environment where you have a lot of talented guys who never get their shot. And they feel like, no matter what I do, I'm not going to get an opportunity. And this guy who's terrible is going to get an opportunity. It's counterproductive to your major league team. You're bringing up the lesser player. And then on top of that, it creates a toxic environment up and down your system where players feel like, I'm not a first round pick. I have no shot unless I go somewhere else to a new organization. So that's what we talk
about. France being a shining example of that with the Padres. 34th round pick, and they gave him every chance to give everybody else.
Yeah, Ty France. He hit his way up. You know, there are times, some previous Padres administrations where, without naming names, there are some first round picks who got called up who did not deserve to be called up, while better players were left to languish in the minors. And this organization didn't do that. They said, we don't care when you were drafted. If you're good, we'll give you a shot. They did that with Ty France. They did that with quite a few of these 30th round picks. You know, David Bednar, Trey Wingenter was a late round pick as well, 19th rounder. So if you perform, you'll get a shot. And that's important to a healthy player development culture. So those are the main aspects of player development we're talking about.
This is maybe taking a bit of a left-hand turn, but does that apply at all to what we saw with Mackenzie Gore this year, just in a season where we figured he would be kind of one of the ones knocking on the door? He'd be a guy, that young crop of pitchers that would make his way up. Obviously something wasn't right, and they held him back. They said, look, this is your role. We don't want to throw you out there as a reliever. We don't want to compromise that. We want you to stick with this role and kind of get sorted out whatever's going on. Does that apply, or is that kind of its own type of situation?
No, that's 100% a good part of having smart player development, is putting players in the majors when they're ready, not forcing it, not trying to rush it, not worrying about, you know, all these other things. Oh, you know, it's a first round pick and he's such a high profile name and want to get, none of that matters. When a guy's ready, put him up. If he's not ready, give him more time. That's proper player development. That's healthy player development. And ultimately that's what's best for the player and the team long-term. So in this case, yeah, Mackenzie Gore is a very, very, very talented young pitcher. He also has 20 some odd innings above A ball. And over the course of, you know, his time at the alternate site, he just, mechanically, the delivery was just off. Just the timing just wasn't really in sync. There's a lot of moving parts there. You know, big leg kick, hands high above the head, slight turn away from the batter. There's a lot of things that have to kind of be firing all at the same time. And for whatever reason, again, this was a really weird year. Guys were dealing with some pretty adverse circumstances. When he returned to the summer camp in July, he was just off. He is hardly the only prospect in minor league baseball that was off. You look through, there's a long list of them. And the Padres said, okay, let's get this smoothed out. And if you're smoothed out in time to bring up to the majors, we'll do it. And if not, it's okay. We'll use this year as a year of development, which was absolutely the right thing to do, the smart thing to do. And by all accounts, he was getting better toward the end of the year. Just at the moment, the Padres kind of needed call-ups. He wasn't quite there yet. He was closer, but just wasn't quite there yet. And they said, all right, we'll give him an offseason. We'll bring him to spring training and continue the work forward. I think the worst thing a team can do is to bring a guy up when he's not ready. It doesn't do him any good. Doesn't do the team any good. So they were absolutely right to hold him down if they didn't feel like he was ready.
Yeah, I've never understood when teams bring up a guy when he's in a, you know, 2-for-18 skid instead of when he's, you know, 9-for-his-last-18, because you're feeling it in that moment. And if he's not right, then you don't want to bring him up and then make him think, shoot, it wasn't really working there. Now it's definitely not working here. Now you've got a mental problem. So bringing him up when he's ready to go and at his best to attack big league hitters, that's what they did with Luis Patino. And, you know, it worked out well. You know, he finally figured out that if he attacks inside the strike zone, his stuff is good enough to get big league hitters out. It took him a little while to figure it out, but he did. And then Ryan Weathers, you know, the guy who was taking the first round the year after Gore, he shows up in the postseason and he opens a ton of eyes because he was a guy who was ready, probably further along, at least more ready at that time than Mackenzie Gore was, especially for a guy who had not pitched above Fort Wayne, which is, you know, Midwest League, you know, low A ball, to come in against the eventual world champion Los Angeles Dodgers and play pitch the way that he did. That's got to be just a massive boost for, you know, those two young guys. And then you still have Gore waiting in the wings.
Yeah, it was certainly impressive to see Ryan Weathers take the jump he did this year. I wrote about it in summer camp when he was really opening some eyes, and he continued to do it throughout his time at the alternate site and earned that call up. You know, Luis Patino, very, very talented. We saw, you know, some flashes of good. We saw some flashes of less good. The biggest thing with him, he's just a very high energy, high adrenaline type of pitcher. And there were a lot of times, you know, and this was true even in the minors as well, I wrote about last year, where he, you know, get too amped up and just start overthrowing and trying to power his way out of situations as opposed to kind of taking a step back and executing. We saw him do that early on. He got, you know, it was a little bit better once he kind of came back up. They sent him back down to the alternate site in early September and came back up, had that really critical inning in the playoff win over the Cardinals in game three. So there's certainly things to build on with both these guys. And again, just because Mackenzie Gore was not in the major leagues does not mean there weren't things to build on. If anything, it's probably a good thing. This guy faced some adversity for, you know, one of the first times in his life. He had blister issues in Fort Wayne that kind of sidetracked him a little bit. But in terms of, you know, fully healthy, working through some things, that's something that everyone faces at some point. And he went through it and, you know, he by all accounts learned from it and made progress and fought through it. And that's good for a guy long term. So all three of these guys went through some different experiences this year. It's only going to help them moving forward. And now we'll see what they're ready to give to the Padres moving forward.
Yeah, one of the things that we've discussed is their concern about them ultimately assuming one of those kind of rotational type roles. Because Morjon's now been around for a couple seasons, and this year he was a 35-pitch guy each time out and get you through a couple few innings. Patino, like you said, kind of had some struggles. Does that mean anything, or should we still feel confident that, you know, come next year at spring training, these guys are going to be in position to potentially be stretched out and prove that they can fill one of those five spots?
Yeah, so some of that's going to depend on what strides they make this offseason and what they do in spring training. These are still very, very young pitchers who are still growing into their bodies, still making giant leaps. I will say that, look, Mackenzie Gore, as I mentioned, has five starts above A-ball. Luis Patino has fewer than that. And while he did some good things in the major leagues this year, he's still very erratic. It was never more than two innings. It's a huge jump to go from that and then say, okay, take the ball every fifth day and give us six quality innings, getting through a lineup two, three times. And Ryan Weathers, as much as that one and a third playoff innings look good, you don't take a guy from low A ball and throw him in a major league rotation. I'm talking to some Padres officials. In a perfect world, all three of these guys start in double A next year. They want to stretch these guys out as starters. They still need to learn the finer points of, okay, this is how I get through a lineup two, three times against advanced hitters, which as talented as these guys are, they don't have that experience yet in any kind of extended capacity. The Padres have some arms to get them through, you know, an opening day rotation potentially of Denelson Lamet. We have to see what his health status is, but Lamet, Paddock, Davies, you know, Joey Lucchese was one of their better starters for two straight years. He has three bad games last year, and Padres fans don't want him anywhere near their club. It makes no sense to me. And then Adrian Morjon, they're going to try and stretch him out, see if they can get him to give them, you know, five innings as their number five starter. So that realistically is your opening day rotation. Again, if Patino and Gore and Weathers all, you know, if one of them makes a huge jump, could they seize a spot? Certainly. But in a perfect world, these guys start in the minors, go back to being, you know, hey, here's six innings in a real competitive environment and learn how to maneuver your way through a double A lineup, you know, not just, you know, once or twice, but do it over three, four, 5 months, go up to AAA and then potentially say, okay, now you're ready to be a starting pitcher in the major leagues and take the ball every fifth day. Do not underestimate how difficult it is to do that. And these kids, while talented, still could use some more time and experience to be ready to do that and be successful when they do that.
Okay, so that gives us a nice, a perfect transition, and well done on setting us up on this, Kyle, to the name that you had to leave out, which, of course, is one Mike Clevinger, the Tommy John surgery. I think that was just a gut punch to a lot of Padres fans because they were talking about now you've got at him and you could take away either, you know, an Amory Horner or a Lucchese, somebody along those lines. So the Padres were going to go into this offseason looking for some sort of starting pitching, either by, you know, a value deal free agent or a trade of some kind. So how much now does not having Clevinger in 2021 put more of an emphasis on AJ Preller to try and add another capable, if not frontline starting pitcher for this year? Because 2022's rotation shaping up to be awfully darn nice. Do they look for a short-term rental? Do they go out and get somebody like a Trevor Bauer for 1 year, maybe? Do they look for somebody like a Charlie Morton for maybe, you know, talk him into pitching one more year at the age of 38 to come back? Is the emphasis now, do they have to, it would have been a bonus before, do they have to now go out and find somebody else to double down on 2020 success?
If they want to try and chase down the Dodgers, yes, absolutely. This is no question a huge blow to the Padres losing a pitcher of Mike Clevenger's caliber. And if you want to, again, compete with the defending World Series champions, who will once again be the best team in Major League Baseball next year, they're going to have to add another high upside arm you feel comfortable slotting into the top two of a rotation. You know, Denelson Lamet is a number one or two starter in the major leagues. But again, we have to see what his health status looks like. It'd be tough to swim in the Trevor Bauer pool with so much money already committed to Myers, Hosmer, and Machado, especially in a year where revenues were down. But I think you look at some of the guys who have at their best been really, really excellent starters, and maybe because of an injury, you can get them at a slightly discounted price. You know, the James Paxtons of the world, the Chris Archers of the world. But again, the Padres have done that before, and it doesn't always work out so great. So if anything, I think you actually kind of have to look and see who maybe some of the pitchers are that don't get tendered a contract. Because I think one of the things that has been a problem with all these free agency previews that are coming out right now is there's going to be a huge number of players who are not tendered contracts on December 2nd. That's the non-tender deadline. And there's going to be a lot of guys who are very, very good players who are going to be available probably at a discount because the market's just going to be so flooded with players. Supply is going to outstrip demand. So I think realistically, for the Padres to say, okay, we are going to compete over a 162-game season, they probably need two more starters, one of whom is in that number two starter mold that you feel really comfortable rolling out to start game two of a potential playoff game, and another guy who you can put at the back in the event that, you know, Lucchese can't recapture his 2018-2019 form, or Adrian Morejone continues to struggle with injuries and durability as he has for a lot of his career. Realistically, that's what you need to do. But again, given the Padres' financial constraints, you know, maybe they can make the numbers work and find a way to go get a Bauer type. That would surprise me given their current payroll commitments and the current environment. I think you have to almost take a shot on one of those higher upside guys. You can get a discount and then see who the non-tender pool of pitchers are and see if you can find a really good value there, because there will be some really good values there.
Does it give them any more incentive to open up the wallets even further? Just the fact that there's a good chance that Dodgers are going to be one of the major players for Trevor Bauer. I mean, just to keep him away from them, you know, do you run the risk of bringing a knife to a gunfight if you try and kind of scrape around for starting pitching while those guys add even more to their talent pool?
I would be very surprised if the Dodgers end up with Trevor Bauer. Again, they're more focused on ensuring they have the money to extend their guys long-term, Bellinger, Seager, et cetera. Again, could the Dodgers make a big play? Of course, they're the Dodgers, but the teams that are at the top of the attendance numbers every year are the teams that lost the most money. The Dodgers are one of those. We saw they had mass layoffs throughout the organization yesterday. They've claimed more than $100 million in losses. Obviously, there are reasons to be skeptical of any MLB team's dollar amount that they claim they've lost in any year. But this did hurt the big market team. So, I don't really – if you're asking me, Trevor Bauer does not end up a Dodger at all. I don't think that happens. I've been wrong before, but looking at the big picture, it would surprise me. And that's not the reason why the Padres should invest $35 million in a player. It's going to be hard for them to spend that kind of cash unless they can move Will Myers' contract. And again, given the belt tightening going on around Major League Baseball right now, I don't know how many other teams are going to be willing to assume that contract, even with Myers having the turnaround he did last year. It's going to be very easy for a lot of teams to say, oh, well, you know, it was 60 games and there are 55 games in Myers' case and how much of it is sustainable. And teams are going to be looking for any excuse they can not to add payroll this year, not to spend money, with the exception of, you know, maybe three or four teams out there. So it would be difficult for the Padres to do that. But again, crazier things have happened, and we have to see how the offseason plays out and what moves are made. But I think if you're a fan, you should expect something in the lower tiers.
And then a couple things to keep in mind, too, is that, one, the Dodgers get David Price back next year. He opted out for COVID. So that's a pretty good, well, assuming he does come back next year, that's a pretty good piece to be able to throw in there to an already pretty, you know, good pitching staff. And with Trevor Bauer, he did decline the qualifying offer for Cincinnati, so you're giving up draft picks and high draft picks. So that's good. Those are two things to keep in mind with those two guys. So now I think we look to the trade avenues. I thought they had a guy like there, like Lance Lynn with Texas. That would be your kind of quintessential one-year rental. And he had a really good year last year. Would he be a guy that maybe the Padres are looking for? Because even with all their wheeling and dealing at the trade deadline, they still have, as you know, a very deep minor league system. Is that the route, the avenue they try and take in order to try and fill that other hole in the rotation?
Again, I think you're going to be looking a lot more at the free agent pool, just because Texas was asking for a lot for Lance Lynn. They were asking for that Patino, you know, Camposano, Abrams tier of prospect, which, you know, for one
so
year.
So that's a no.
Right. For one year, the Padres are right not to give that up. And to be honest, the Rangers, to me, are the single organization in baseball right now that's the most disconnected from reality in thinking how good their players actually are and what their players are actually worth. Again, do the Padres have the prospects to swing any deal they want like that? Yes, but would they want to trade away a top 50 overall prospect, another guy who might be a top 100 prospect, and more for a guy like Lance Lynn at just one year of him? Probably not. And it would be smart not to go do that. So again, I think Padres fans want to hear, oh, they're going to get Trevor Bauer. Oh, they're going to go get Lance Lynn. Realistically, look more at the Jose Quintanas of the world, you know, maybe the James Paxtons of the world, the Taiwan Walkers of the world. Like, look more toward the free agent group of guys you can get on 1 or 2 year deals who, for whatever reason, injury or performance, plus the state of the market, you can get for a little bit cheaper. That's what we're looking at.
Back to Clevinger. I mean, how concerned should we be? His second Tommy John, it sounded like something happened the end of that 7-inning complete game against the Giants. That's at least what AJ Preller kind of pointed to. He felt some discomfort, missed a start because of bicep tightness. Then, you know, I think it was 10 days after that Giants start, he doesn't come back after the first inning and then tries to come back. And Preller didn't seem to, and, you know, doesn't surprise you, but didn't seem to think that them collectively, including Clevinger, attempting to pitch in the playoffs had anything to do with him needing this procedure now, and that, you know, it was probably something that was present after that Giants game that they were going to have to clean up. Should we be concerned that, you know, we might not necessarily see the Clevinger we thought would come to San Diego off the heels of so many successful seasons with the Indians?
Yeah, anytime you're talking about two-time Tommy John surgery recipients, you have to be concerned. There's not a great track record of those guys coming back and being the standouts they were. And you have to keep in mind with Clevinger, durability has always been the concern. You look at his track record, and he's a great pitcher when he's on the mound. He'd also thrown more than 126 innings once in his entire major league career. You know, it was his 121 innings. He had one 200 inning season, and then 2019 dealt with injuries as well. Made 21 starts, missed, you know, 10, 11 starts from what a normal front of the rotation guy gets. So look, it's a very effortful delivery. There's always been concern about how much he would hold up because of that. He's a great athlete. He's super strong, and he was able to make it work and be effective. But again, durability and health has never been his strong suit. Now you're adding a second Tommy John on top of it. And the other part of it too is we see this all the time. A guy's first year back from Tommy John surgery, which is what the Padres would get in the second year of this deal. He missed all of 2021, come back 2022, his first year back from Tommy John surgery. First year back often is not great. It's the second year back where guys really find their form and become the guy they were pre-surgery. So there's a very real chance, given the history here, that the Padres will not get the Mike Clevinger they hoped they'd get. And that's why, for me, I thought it was curious that they gave him a two-year deal, because to me, in order to make this work out, it has to be a three-year deal. You need to get that second year off of Tommy John surgery to really have, in my opinion, realistic hope of getting the guy you gave up a lot for in a trade.
We saw that with Trevor Rosenthal this year, where he kind of muddled along a little bit coming back. And then you see it a lot with, it's like location. Command tends to be the last thing, especially with the off-speed pitches, because they're such feel pitches. You have to be able to really get back and A, trust your body to be able to be okay, and then B, get your body back to where you know you can feel the pitches again. And then once Trevor Rosenthal got back to being him, he was great. Garrett Richards came back at the end of 2019, and you saw him very erratic, and then he was much better for stretches of 2020, which brings us to, do they think now about re-signing Garrett Richards?
You certainly look at it. Again, I can't say this enough. That pool of 1 or 2 year, deals for guys like that is where the Padres are likely going to be swimming here. And if, is Garrett Richards, would he be a better signing than Jose Quintana? Probably not. Would he be a better signing than Chris Archer or James Paxton? I think you could argue yes, given he's performed more than those guys have recently. But I would rather have Taijuan Walker and Jose Quintana. You can make the argument for even, an older guy. If Charlie Morton is amenable, though by all accounts, he really wants to stay in Tampa and wants to stay in Florida so he can be closer to his family. You mentioned Corey Kluber earlier. I mean, theoretically, you could go after him. Adam Wainwright, did okay last year. So, again, that's the group we're looking at. For me personally, I trust a one-year deal for Adam Wainwright or a two-year deal for Taijuan Walker, Jose Quintana, more than a one-year deal for Garrett Richards. But sure, you can absolutely consider Richards, and he's certainly a guy you can look at and definitely should not be off the table by any stretch.
Preller said that, look, we had all the information. Sometimes this just happens. Do you believe him, or do you think there's some buyer's remorse on Clevinger now?
I think both can be true. If the Padres knew he was going to need Tommy John surgery, they wouldn't have acquired him. So, of course, you can never fully know, but things can still happen, and you can still feel buyer's remorse. They said, these things happen. Pitchers will break your heart. They're very fickle. Injuries are a very, very, very big part of the calculation whenever you're acquiring any pitcher. And you bake that in, you make the decision, you want the talent, and sometimes this happens. So again, both things can be true, that you always know this is a possibility, but you say we need the talent, we want the talent, decide that trumps all. And then when it happens, of course, you have a little bit of buyer's remorse. That's human instinct.
Kyle, we touched on this a little bit earlier with the young pitchers, but you are going to be putting out the top 10 Padres prospects for Baseball America. Expecting that early January, probably, you were saying, because National League West is one of the last ones to do.
Yeah, so we'll hit the web in January. We're putting together the prospect handbook, which goes to press just before Christmas. And I believe the book normally gets to people who pre-order it online at the end of January. So there's a chance you could get the book with all 30 Padres prospects before the top 10 goes online, but it'll be close. But yes, we're putting together all of our top 30s and top 10s for every major league team, and the Padres, just by virtue of being the NL West and also alphabetically being near the bottom, they go after the Diamondbacks, the Rockies, and some of the other organizations, the Dodgers. They're going to be one of the last ones released, but it It's in process. I turned in actually the list to my editors a few days ago, and it's a good one. Again, the Padres traded a lot of prospects to really bulk up at the trade deadline, but because they've built such an incredible amount of depth, you still are looking at a very, very good system that, in my opinion, is still a top five system in baseball. It's not number one. It's probably not number two, but if you've got a, you know, 3-4-5 farm system and you had the second best record in the National League last year, you're in a really good place as a franchise.
So then let me ask you this, knowing what we know about AJ Preller, even if it's not for a starting pitcher, how many of the guys that are on your list now will still be on the list by the time it gets released to the public?
Well, again, I just go back to the cost of acquiring a pitcher, a quality pitcher as a free agent, is going to be a lot lower than the cost of acquiring a quality pitcher on the trade market this year. So I think that when you're looking at the top group, there's no question, Mackenzie Gore, CJ Abrams, Luis Patino, Luis Camposano, those four will still be Padres when this list comes out in January, barring a trade for, you know, a Cy Young caliber pitcher who is under contract for 3 years, which, yes, it could happen, but I don't think it will. You know, the next group of guys, again, probably more inclined to keep. I think if we see trades, again, it's going to be more the guys who are in that, you know, 10 to 20 range of the system, 10 to 25 range, which is where the Padres have mostly traded from, whether it was, you know, their offseason deals last year, it was young major leaguers or prospects in that realm for the most part. The deadline as well, they traded Taylor Trammell and Gabriel Arias, who were top 10 prospects, but beyond them, it was young major leaguers and a lot of depth prospect types. So it's a long way of saying, I don't think it will change much because, again, I can't emphasize this enough. There are going to be really good pitchers available after the non-tender deadline for stupid cheap. There's no reason to trade two of your top 10 prospects for a pitcher you can probably go get for a 2-year, $20 million deal because he was non-tendered.
I love how we throw around $20 million. It's like, that's nothing. You know,
welcome
to baseball economics. Just give him $20 million bucks. That's easy.
I mean, $10 million a year, you know, we've seen a couple of these one-year deals come out. You know, Drew Smiley for 1 year, $11 million. And yeah, again, in the grand scheme of the world, yes, that's a lot of money. But again, if you look at the Padres and what they could do, maybe it's a 2-year, $16 million deal. You know, there are going to be players who, because of the way the market is shaping up this year, would normally be $15 million a year, $16 million a year guys, $18 million a year guys, you're going to be able to get for $8 million a year, $9 million a year, $10 million a year. And then the good teams will understand this is going to be a tremendous opportunity to get better at a much lower price point than usual. They just have to come up with the funds, which some teams are going to be able to do more easily than others.
Well, I hope there aren't too many deals involving Padres prospects because you've got enough on your plate with all these prospect lists. So that means you're having to bug your editors to change a few, at least a couple top 10. So for your sake, I hope that doesn't happen. Anything on the website right now that folks should check out?
Yeah, so we're rolling out top 10s for all 30 teams. We've got podcasts for all 30 teams as well as their lists are coming out. So go ahead and check those out on the website. I've got a piece next week coming out about some of the players who really stood out to opposing scouts in Instructional League. Instructional League was really the only place scouts were able to go and get live looks at guys this year. So we used all our sources, really networked our guys here at Baseball America and got some dope on who was looking really, really good out there. So that piece is coming out next week and people are definitely going to want to take a look at that and to see who some of the scouts turning heads and instructs were.
Anybody of Padres interest? I don't want you to give away too much.
Yeah. No, I'm fine talking about some Padres guys. So not all these guys are going to be on that list, but three pitchers for the Padres who did some good things this year. Efrain Contreras, right-hander, Omar Cruz, a left-hander. Both these guys were signed out of Mexico back in 2017. Both got to Fort Wayne last year and pitched very well there. Both of them really took some steps forward in instructs, showing some better velocity and really just showing a good feel to pitch. Contreras especially just commanding everything in the zone. And Reese Kinnear, who is another pitcher, he was a two-way player at Fordham. And we see a lot of times with the college two-way players, when they focus on pitching only in pro ball, their stuff ticks up, everything gets a little sharper, their control's a little more hemmed in. So he struggled last year with kind of an aggressive assignment to high class A Lake Elsinore, but came back this year in instructs and everything was looking a little firmer. Control was better, fastball ticked up, slider ticked up, everything looked better. So those are three pitchers who did some good things in instructs. And then both CJ Abrams and Robert Hassel, their first round picks each the last 2 years, just continuing to draw rave reviews both inside and outside the organization.
Those two guys you just mentioned in Abrams and Hassel, interesting to me because they're not your power guys, at least not yet. They are your, you know, foul pole to foul pole, speed, find gaps, create havoc on the base pass types of players, which I love seeing that type of guy coming back into Major League Baseball and really being valued as assets in the game today. Are we seeing a bit of a switch now? Are we still kind of maybe – is this like a generation away from now the steroid era where the game is of getting these kinds of guys? Because that's what, instead of trying to bulk everybody up or turn them all into 40 home run a year guys, they're letting guys be the kinds of players that they are. And speed now is something that teams value again. Because I love that type of, you know, slash a double to left center, take off, steal third base. The next guy lays down a perfect, you know, safety squeeze and reaches first. I love that kind of game along with the long ball.
There's no question there's certain elements of that that's true, that understanding having players who are varied and can do a bunch of different things for you is important, as opposed to being all or nothing slugger types. But more than that, it's an understanding that power comes last. That is an old scouting mantra. It is very, very, very true. It's a lot easier to get a guy stronger and, you know, let him grow into some power over time than it is to try and teach him strike zone recognition, barrel control, you know, being able to wait back on breaking balls, having some feel for hitting. You want to see the hitting components in place first and let the power come later. You know, Christian Yelich is a great example of that. And Cody Bellinger hit one home run his senior year of high school. He was a hit over power guy. Corey Seager, same deal, hit over power. Carlos Correa hit single digit home runs at the lower levels. Power comes last. And the best teams understand that. Fine guys who can hit first, who are good athletes, that make contact, that recognize pitches, that control the strike zone, that can use the whole field. Find that, and then those guys will all get bigger and stronger, especially the high school guys. So Abrams and Hassel are not purely always going to be slash and dash guys. These are both very skinny teenagers with room to grow into some more strength and power. CJ Abrams projects when he fills out his body. You know, I compare him to a baby dinosaur. He's going to be a monster. He's still very skinny, kind of, you know, long neck, like, but when he fills out, he's going to be a monster. There's no question in anyone's mind, this guy will be able to hit 20 home runs, if not more, when he reaches physical maturity. He just has such an incredible feel to hit and athleticism. That's also going to come with a high average. Robert Hassel as well, amazing pure hitter, just a beautiful left-handed stroke geared for hard contact. Again, really skinny guy, but has big hands, has wide shoulders. That guy's going to get stronger. Maybe it's, depending on who you talk to, maybe it's 12 to 14 home runs. Maybe it's 16 to 18. Maybe it is 20. We have to see how he fills out. But again, find the guys who can hit first and power comes later. That's what successful development, especially of high school hitters, looks like. The guys who are all power but swing and miss in high school, those guys top out in AA, AAA. Those are not your star major leaguers.
I really want to see baby dinosaur on the back of like one of those players weekend nickname jerseys one of these years for the Padres. I think that'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, again, just the first time I saw him, that was my first thought. It's kind of a baby dinosaur. He's going to be a monster when he fills out. He's already very, very, very good, and he's only going to continue to get better as he fills out and gets stronger. And obviously, you know, has to stay healthy. There's all sorts of things that can happen in player development. We're talking about, you know, a kid who has two games above rookie ball, right? So there's a whole wide range of outcomes. No one should ever assume a sure thing, but all the pieces you want to see are there in his case. And Same with Robert Hassel. Again, for a young high school hitter, this is what the successes look like at this age. Now, he still has to develop physically. There's a lot of guys who never do add the power. Think about a guy like, you know, Blake Rutherford was another really highly touted high school hitter with all this field to hit, but never was able to impact a baseball, and it's affected him. So nothing is guaranteed, but this is what they look like. And now I just have to see how the physical development kind of unfolds.
Did we just see that with Trent Grisham? Whereas he had low home run numbers in the minor leagues, and then all of a sudden, like 2 years ago, boom, he reaches double digits. And now it obviously is translating, at least in some cases, a 23-year-old in center field for the Padres.
He's a little bit of a different case because he had some strength. His issue was an awful, awful, awful approach, and frankly, an awful, awful, awful swing. It was a truly horrendous swing when he was down in the Carolina League in A-ball. But he had athleticism, and he had, you know, some of the raw components you could work with. And once they let him get back to his unconventional but comfortable for him hand grip on the bat, he holds it more like a golf club than a baseball bat. Started to get better. He started hitting the ball out front more. So that was more of an approach and swing adjustment than a growing into strength thing, because he was a bigger guy. I actually thought that he had a concerningly kind of thick lower half when I saw him in Carolina in 2017. If anything, I think he actually kind of trimmed up, and you know, maybe that's the case where he got stronger, but it wasn't so much him filling out as kind of, you know, leaning out and becoming more physically, you know, strong in the right places.
You've let us keep you for an hour, and if you're not careful, we might keep you for a few more. Always appreciate having you on, and I know I always learn a lot. So pleasure is all ours. Thanks as always for spending some time with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. Always enjoy talking baseball with you.